Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Tuesday, August 11th, welcome, 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 friends, on Into the Program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
So what if you could buy yourself more time for fertility? Not stop aging, not guarantee a baby, but create another option for a future you who may want to become a parent. That's what more women are trying to do by freezing their eggs. And this week, Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, aka AOC, made that decision unusually public. She's 36, she's considering her political future, and says freezing her eggs is a way to feel more in control of her life. That word control is really at the center of today's conversation because science has changed dramatically. Women now have reproductive options that barely existed a generation ago. And more women than ever, they're leaning in, they're going for it. But biology hasn't disappeared. Egg freezing is expensive, it's physically demanding, and there's no guarantee that you will have a baby. So today, we're asking two questions at the same time. First, what is this technology? What can it actually do? And second, why do so many women feel like they need it? We have two great guests that'll walk us through, talk about the trend, talk about the science, talk about some of the social pressures. And of course, we would love to hear from you, our listeners. Our question of the day: how have you thought about fertility as you age and balance other life goals? If you have a story you'd like to share, maybe you or your partner decided to go with egg freezing or some other medical fertility technology, give us a call, 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, you can leave a comment in the live chat.
And I'll just emphasize again, we love your stories. We love your calls, your emails. That will really enrich the show today. Mm-hmm. And so if you feel comfortable sharing, that number's right there, 888-477-9499. Again, the email studio2@whyy.org. Also, when you said AKA AOC, it made me realize that that has a very lyric, a poetic quality to it.
You know,
AKA AOC.
I like to do what I do.
And whether you like her politics or not, she has been remarkably public about this. She even posted a video of
giving herself
an injection, right? And so it has opened up this whole conversation. We'd love for you to join it today. But first, our trio of local news stories. So Pennsylvania's Attorney General, Dave Sunday, says he backs a federal effort to crack down on hemp-derived products that contain even small amounts of THC. According to Spotlight PA, he co-signed a letter with more than 30 other attorneys general. That's the proper plural, by the way. Attorneys general.
That's right.
Who back new government hemp rules. A little science lesson, briefly, tangent: hemp and marijuana, they're from the same plant species. Hemp contains less of the psychoactive compound THC. And under the old rules, the old definitions, legal hemp could contain up to 0.3% of Delta-9 THC when harvested. And that allowed for the proliferation of legal drinks and gummies that could lead to intoxication. Mm-hmm. Many contained a compound called Delta-8 THC, slightly different. The feds want to change the rules and say, look, basically almost no amount of THC in any form is okay. And that would effectively eliminate a big class of products that had kind of entered the market through this loophole. And backers of the ban say that's what we have to do. We have to close the loophole because we're selling essentially weed-adjacent products legally on the market that can get you high. But Pennsylvania hemp growers say, look, this new rule would also ban products that have no intoxicating effect and have become a central part of their industry. Because since 2018, PA has allowed people to grow hemp legally under a license. And one grower told Spotlight PA, look, we played by the rules, and now you're coming in and you're saying you might shut us down, even though we never did anything wrong. That's not fair. As of now, this ban, this change is going to go into effect in November, but there's a possibility lawmakers in Washington could delay it.
Yeah, I will not be surprised if there is a delay, because people might not know this, but the hemp-derived products industry makes anywhere between $28 and $64 billion with a B $1.4 billion a year nationwide. That's a lot of money.
Sure.
$1.4 billion in Pennsylvania. That's the economic impact here. And folks are not going to give that up without a fight. And you got to understand the industry response, because it's like a game of business whiplash.
Sure.
The lawmakers tell you this is legal. You build your whole business around this. You build all these products. A lot of these products they're talking about, you can get them on Amazon. Mm-hmm. You can get them anywhere, right?
Yep.
And then boom, you got to change everything.
It's a switcheroo for sure.
It's a switcheroo.
That said, I think when you enter into a virgin industry, you understand there's a lot of risk involved.
That is true.
Because the government's saying, we're going to try this. And when the government tries something, you always know that's not a commitment that they're always going to allow it. So I sympathize with the feeling of whiplash, but I think you could also have an expectation. If you're signing up in 2018 for legal hemp growing in Pennsylvania, a state that doesn't have...
And they were clicking off the years. They're like, we almost made it to a decade.
Yeah, exactly. You know there's some volatility in that sector.
And they did give them some notice. This is not, you know, but I think, you know, we'll see.
There already is pushback, so you're right about that. Story number two, Cherry.
Yes, a Michelin star restaurant based in Rittenhouse Square just scored $1.5 million grant from the state that will allow it to expand. The restaurant is Friday, Saturday, Sunday. You probably heard of it. It's a Beard Award-winning fine dining establishment known for its 8-course tasting menu.
And it's tasty.
Yeah, and it has big ambitions. So the restaurant plans to use the state grant to extend its 21st Street location to 2 adjacent parcels along Rittenhouse Square. The goal, according to his Redevelopment Assistance Capital Grant application, is to create a, quote, world-class dining destination.
Oh, baby.
Yeah, this concept is multi-level. It will feature an open kitchen, group dining areas, and a suites room.
What's a suites room?
Apparently a room full of sweets. Okay, desserts.
I got to see the sweets room. I don't even like sweets that much, but I want to know what a sweets room is.
And according to their application, that a sweets room does not exist anywhere else on the East Coast.
I didn't know it existed, period.
Yeah, it's so cool. So Friday, Saturday, Sunday claims it would create one of the most ambitious restaurants in the United States and the first minority owned restaurant of its kind. Owners Chad and Hannah Williams took over Friday, Saturday, Sunday back in 2015. They've transformed it, elevating it to one of the must dine places in the city. And according to the Philadelphia Business Journal, property records indicate that they were in the process of actually purchasing that Rittenhouse property. And I should mention that this real estate, this redevelopment assistance capital program is a state run grant program to fund the design, acquisition, and construction of improvement projects. This year alone, the Shapiro administration gave out $124 million in grants all across the state. You have to have matching funds. And so this total project that Friday, Saturday, Sunday is trying to implement is $3.8 million.
Yeah, sweets room aside, I was just surprised to hear that a kind of smallish fine dining restaurant was pursuing such a large expansion in a very obviously buzzy, attractive neighborhood, and that the state was stepping in to help them with this. It's a confluence of things. I just didn't expect all to see at the center of one Venn diagram, because you often hear about these really exclusive restaurants maintaining that air of exclusivity, not necessarily like becoming big, bold, multi-unit like dining experiences with separate rooms. I'm just interested to see how it plays out, because there was some cognitive dissonance for me. I'm trying to imagine what it might look like.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to be watching this one. And I've never been there. I know you have.
Yeah, so you got to go.
I got to go. But it's hard to get in now because it's only so many spots.
That's true.
So,
and also, save some pennies before you go.
Stack it. Yeah, he's telling me to stack it. Yeah.
Stack it. From fine dining now to find dining, as in how do you find this place? The Inquirer claims the best chicken sandwich in Philly is at a corner store in Point Breeze that maybe doesn't even have a name.
No name.
No name. Great story by Kiki Aranita. The spot, which again, we don't know what to call it because it might not have a name. It's located at 17th and Wharton, South Philly, just a couple blocks west of Broad Street. It looks like a normal corner store. It's owned by a couple, Linda and Jimmy Kong, who immigrated from Vietnam, met here in Philly. And the sandwich that they serve is not fancy. It's just a couple of like fried chicken cutlets, lettuce, tomato, onion, pickles, mayo on bread, like potato bread, not even a bun. But apparently it's banging. It's the best chicken sandwich in the city of Philadelphia.
What?
And they're cranking it out at this regular little corner store. And it might be called Kim Lo corner store, but there's no clear signage.
Don't quote me, man.
So no one really knows, which I found to be interesting. And they've been making these sandwiches for many years. And only recently people like in social media and the foodie community like kind of caught on. And it sounds like the owners of the store are a little amused and surprised by all of this.
I have to say, nothing like a good fried chicken sandwich. The simpler, the better, I think.
Really?
I do.
You don't want a fancy sauce.
I don't want a fancy sauce. I don't want a whole bunch of stuff on there. And the Kongs, they seem to understand that. And remember when the Popeye's chicken sandwich went crazy?
I do remember that.
And it was
that.
Pretty
it's a good
simple.
Callback.
It
yeah.
was it was pretty simple. You know, it was just chicken sandwich on a bun with one pickle right in the middle. Boom.
Right.
And people loved it. I think there's like it's the breading and the grease that you fried in. Those two are the secrets.
Well, apparently their breading's very simple. And I think these people are genuinely shocked that there's all this buzz, but great for them. Great
you know
for
what?
Them.
I might you know have to you go down there and though? Give me a chicken sandwich.
You know, I think you need the pickle.
I love a good pickle, man.
I do think I'm with you. Maybe don't make it too fancy. Don't overthink
well,
it.
Put that pickle on there.
But give me that pickle because there's something about the acidity there that
yeah,
really works with the crunch and the fry, whatever. Put that conversation aside. We're going to talk about the large increase in the number of women who are freezing their eggs. That conversation is ahead on Studio 2. Don't go anywhere.
And welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron. Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez made headlines over the weekend. The 36-year-old is starting the process of freezing her eggs as she weighs her political future. Here she is talking about it on ABC.
I think it's important for us as leaders to have these conversations and share these processes, especially for working women across the country, and normalize them.
Yeah, AOC told her followers that the decision was motivated by a desire to have more control over her life, something that a lot of women can relate to. Many are putting off childbearing as they balance other life goals related to career and, of course, finding the right partner.
So this hour, we're diving into the complicated calculus with two great guests. With us in studio is Corinne Lowe, economics professor at Wharton, writer behind the Feminomics Substack, and author of Having It All, What Data Tells Us About Women's Lives and Getting the Most Out of Yours. Corinne, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me. Good to see you again.
And let me welcome in Dr. Anne Hutchinson, reproductive endocrinologist at CCRM Fertility of Delaware and Philadelphia. Thanks for being here on Studio 2.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yes. And for you, our listeners, as always, we'd love to hear from you. Our question of the day, how have you thought about fertility as you age and balance other life goals? And if you have a story, a personal story you'd like to share, this is a safe space. The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for our listeners on YouTube or Facebook, you can put your comments in the live chat.
And we weren't planning to do this, but this is a very personal topic for mm-hmm. so many people. And I'd love to start with a story. And I think we have a caller on the line right
yeah.
now who wants to share her story. This is Julia from Philadelphia. Hey, Julia, you're on Studio 2. Did you have a personal story about this topic you wanted to share?
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on. I wanted to share that I'm 40 years old now. I froze my eggs at age 35. And even 5-6 years ago, the conversation was not as out in the open, and there was a lot of shame around it. And so seeing AOC make that announcement, I sent the headlines around to lots of friends. And I've counseled a lot of other women on it, and I would encourage this conversation to be out in the open. There's a lot of shame around it and privilege allowed if you have the ability to do this, but talk to your friends about it. Ask your employers if they have fertility coverage. I'm sure our guests will talk about that.
Yeah.
But it opens up, at least it opened up for me, kind of a emotional insurance policy. I did it without a partner and with the support of time and family. But yeah, having the conversation and kind of deflates the shame. And AOC, whatever you think of her, very proud of her for putting it out there
yeah.
as an example.
An emotional insurance
yeah,
policy. It's a
I
really
like
interesting
that.
Way to put it. And I thank you, Julia, mm-hmm. from Philadelphia, for that call. I'll keep those calls coming, by the way, 888-477-9499. I want to read the statistic here. This is from author Natalie Lampert. In 2009, 482 healthy women in the U.S. froze their eggs. It's 2009, mm-hmm. not that long ago. Mm-hmm. In 2022, nearly 23,000 mm-hmm. did. That's roughly a 4,000% increase in just over a decade. So, Dr. Ann Hutchinson, on the science side, what happened to affect that change?
Yeah, so it turns out that freezing eggs is technically quite difficult. An egg is a single cell. So while IVF has been an option, it's generally been around while it is constantly evolving over the course of the last 47, 48 years, egg freezing hasn't been. Egg freezing is something that's really only been available for probably about the last 15 years or so mm-hmm. to the general public. It was initially used experimentally for folks who were getting ready to undergo chemotherapy as a kind of experimental last-ditch effort to allow them to preserve what fertility they could before undergoing treatment that could impact their ability to have kids later. But it really opened to the public around 2010. Initially, freezing eggs was something that it took a little bit of practice for us to get really good at. Not every egg that we froze would thaw and be usable. And that's still the case. But even over the course of the last 15 years, as we've been doing it more and more often, we've gotten better at our freeze techniques. We've gotten better at our thaw techniques. It's become a more efficient process.
Has there been a single technological breakthrough or sort of a lot of small ones?
There have been a lot of small ones, but the biggest one has been how we actually freeze the oocyte or that single cell egg. We used to do something called slow freezing those eggs, which is exactly what it sounds like. We lower the temperature of that egg very slowly. And we kind of turn that egg, we crystallize it in ice. Now we do something called vitrification, which is the same way that we freeze embryos as well, which is essentially using liquid nitrogen. It allows us to freeze that egg very rapidly and essentially turn it to glass. So there's less damage that happens in that process, and we're able to thaw more usable eggs and make this process a bit more efficient as we do it more and more frequently. And those changes, we continue to do more and more research in that area and try to be more efficient with that process to try to make the most out of every single egg that these folks have frozen for their future.
And before we bring Corinne into the conversation, I want to talk about what it takes for an individual woman mm-hmm. to put her body through the process. Because, mm-hmm. yes, there's a science that exists once the egg is out of yep. the woman's body. But how can you walk us through how who's a good candidate, who's not, yeah. and just sort of how you extract that egg?
100%. So you're exactly right. Getting the egg into the embryology lab is really what makes up the work of this process. And there are people who can be better candidates just based on medical background stuff. But generally, it's something that's available to everybody. It's just the efficiency of the process is really going to be dictated by the number of eggs that are available and the age at which they're undergoing that process. Mm. So the biology that we're really trying to take advantage of in the background is that women are born with all the eggs we're ever going to have, right? We're born with a couple 100,000 eggs within our ovary. We go through those eggs very inefficiently throughout our reproductive life. We run out of them in menopause, essentially. But each month, as we go through that ovulatory process, there's a group of these eggs that rise into competition. They're selected within the ovary through mechanisms that we don't entirely understand, but they rise into competition each month. The brain's job is to select just one of those eggs to grow and ovulate each month. Fundamentally, your brain tries to protect you from twins. It is very careful to only release enough of this hormone to grow and release one of those eggs from that cohort each month. The rest of them disappear in the background. So if you have 20 eggs that rise into competition from that background rate of thousands and thousands, you have 20 that rise into competition, your brain would naturally select one and 19 would disappear in the background, and the next month you get another 20. What we do during an egg freeze process or any ovarian stimulation process, whether it's the first step of egg freezing or the first step of IVF, the process looks the same. We give a woman additional FSH, or follicle stimulating hormone. So that's the same hormone the brain releases enough of to naturally get one to grow in a usual cycle. We are giving more FSH to allow stimulation of the FSH receptors of all of those available eggs within the ovary for the month to grow and mature. And that process takes about 10 to 12 days of FSH exposure. That timeline isn't any different in a natural cycle than it is during an ovarian stimulation cycle, but we're just putting our foot on the gas pedal and getting more FSH into the mix. We watch follicle size physically increase using ultrasound during that time.
Going back and forth to the doctor entire time?
So it's about a 10 to 12 day process of medication. The medication are small subcutaneous injections. So we teach folks how to give them to themselves at home. They're going to be administering them nightly during that period. We're bringing them in for ultrasound 3 or 4 times during that 10-day process to watch those physical follicles grow on ultrasound. And we use blood work to monitor estrogen levels, which is produced from those follicles as they grow. But ultimately, we're looking for kind of an ideal follicle size that represents a good, usable, mature egg at the end of the process. Once they reach that point, We use something called a trigger medication to get those eggs to undergo that final step of maturation that they would naturally do before they ovulate. And right before those eggs ovulate, we do an egg retrieval, which is a small procedure that's done under sedation in one of our procedure rooms.
It's outpatient.
Through an IV, 10-minute procedure, transvaginal ultrasound with a small little needle that passes through the back of the vagina into each of those follicles.
I hear this. Okay, Corinne, you know, we just talked through the whole science. And I know you went through this.
Yes.
So we had Dr. Hutchison, Dr. Ann over here breaking it all down. So yes. Tell us a little bit about your journey and why you, because this is these are multiple steps. It takes days. It's not cheap. And you walk us through your journey and the decision first, why you decided to do this.
Well, it's ironic because I am an economist who studies women's fertility, and I wrote my dissertation about it. I coined the term reproductive capital to represent the economic value of your fertility, the economic value of the option value that AOC is giving herself to be able to pursue whatever she wants in her career and know that she's going to save some of that reproductive capital. And so the irony was I studied it long before I needed any of these interventions myself. I had my first son sort of naturally when I was 32 years old, got divorced. You can read all about it in my book. And then found myself saying, well, if I want to have another child, now I need to give myself that same option value because I'm not there right now. I'm not with the partner where I'm ready to have a child. And, you know, I need to figure out my next step. So because in my case, I was going to either be having another child on my own or with a same-sex partner, I started looking at freezing embryos. And the reason for this was and this is why AOC is doing the right thing, having this conversation at 36, because when I went into my doctor at 38, they showed me a chart that said, okay, well, when you're freezing eggs, if you have 20 eggs and you freeze 20 eggs and you're 35 or younger, that's a 90% chance of a live birth. But if you're 38, it goes down to 70%. Mm. If you're 40, it goes down to 50%. So you're needing to freeze more eggs, go through more cycles in order to be successful. So she said, you know, sometimes we recommend freezing embryos because you kind of, if you are on the path that I was on, you know, because then you know what you have, you know that they're good. They also can freeze a little bit better, even though technology
you're reducing some of the uncertainty by freezing embryos, which are fertilized, as opposed to just freezing eggs, which is a little earlier in the process.
Exactly.
Am I understanding that
right? Okay. And I'll explain a little bit more about my journey with that. But as she was talking, I was, you know, just reliving my process. They say, oh, yeah, we teach you to get the injections yourself. And I gave myself the wrong medication one time. Because they send you home with a bag of medication. You have to give it at different times. There's different points in the cycle where you start different medications. Two of them had very similar names.
Yes.
And then I call my doctor in a panic being like, I realize this is the wrong medication. You know, so
did you have to start over or was that okay?
It was early enough in the cycle that they said, it's okay. You can just keep going with the right medication. But it might seem kind of, on paper, here's the steps, but you're not a nurse. You don't know what you're doing.
No,
right?
And giving yourself an injection is hard enough by itself.
Yes, and emotionally can sometimes feel hard because sometimes when you're going through this process, as I was going through it after divorce, you're in a point in your life where you're saying, I kind of wish things were different. I wish I was in that relationship where I was ready to have a baby right now and everything had worked out in this one linear path. And so sometimes it's also emotionally hard in addition to the physical. Mm-hmm. So physically, you know, giving the injections and then going in about every other day to get a transvaginal ultrasound to get blood drawn, I had to get over my fear of needles real quick. Okay?
There's a lot involved.
You went into this with a fear of needles.
Yeah, I mean, I always I had the same when I was pregnant with my first son. You have to get a lot of blood drawn when you're pregnant too, and you kind of just have to be like, all right, I got to get over this. I got to make this happen. But you're going in and getting your blood drawn because they have to monitor your hormone levels to know, you know, make sure to adjust your medication, make sure they don't overstimulate or understimulate. And then you go in and you have that procedure under anesthesia. And so that can feel a little, you know, a little scary.
Yeah.
At the same time, it's all doable. You know, there's no lasting impact on your body that's, you know, the way pregnancy leaves you with a lasting impact for a long time. You're going to have a pretty, you know, fast recovery. But definitely as I was going through it, you feel bloated. One of my friends described it as feeling like you're
huge,
full of tadpoles because you're like,
and it's like your little abdomen.
Because your ovaries are much larger than they should be, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the soreness and crampiness after you go through the procedure itself.
Mm. Yeah. Well, I want to read our question again. We're asking you, our listeners today, how have you thought about fertility as you age and balance other life goals? Do you have a story on this topic, freezing eggs, freezing embryos, IVF. 888-477-9499 is our number. Our email is studio2@whyy.org. YouTube, Facebook, comment in the live chat. And I wanted to read this comment from Luann in Glenside, who says, just an observation. The age of the egg is really what's the most important aspect of fertility. Why wait until you're in your mid-30s? Freezing them in your 20s would be more ideal. Also, she adds as an aside, men need to take more responsibility for childcare. We're going to get to that in a second. Dr. Ann Hutchinson, I am curious about that. Are you meeting more people that are coming in, maybe even in their 20s, saying I want to freeze eggs for this exact reason?
I am. And I think that, you know, there are two sides to this conversation, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that when I meet somebody in their 20s who's interested in egg freezing, a lot of it really has to do with what their path is, right?
Yeah.
So I think the biggest risk for somebody in their 20s moving forward with egg freezing is that maybe they don't need to ever use those eggs, right?
Yeah.
Maybe they end up on a path where they're in a place where they're ready to, you know, pursue their first pregnancy in their late 20s or their early 30s, and they have no difficulty achieving pregnancies with all the kids they ever want to have.
Right.
In which case, they've gone through the process and had the expense of freezing eggs, which
and the expense is about what per cycle?
Well, so more insurances are starting to cover it, which I think is a separate topic of conversation. I think that's part of what's made this so much more accessible and why it's become so much more common that we do it. Out of pocket, it's in the neighborhood of $5,000 to $10,000, depending on medications.
So that's the sort of the risk reward or the balance there for the younger folks, is that they might be doing this unnecessarily.
Correct. I think that's the biggest risk. But there are some folks in their 20s who may realize that at some point they need to use IVF to be able to build their family, right? Yeah. Depending on what they want their family to look like. Potentially they have a family history of a certain genetic condition that they know that they're going to end up pursuing IVF to build their family in the long term anyway, in which case, heck yes, let's go ahead and get those eggs out as soon as possible and take advantage of the quantity and quality that's available within a 25-year-old's ovaries.
Sorry, just to clarify, sorry to cut you off, but just to clarify, the genetic component, that would be because they might want to screen out certain risk factors or diseases when they have their child, and they could do that if they do it through IVF.
Yes.
And it sounds like this is a very new issue, though, because 15 years ago, like you said, 20-some-year-olds wouldn't have had this option even before them. So I want to talk a little bit more about the why, Corinne, because, you know, different people have different reasons for wanting to pursue this. And I want to make clear that whether you decide to freeze embryos or to harvest eggs and freeze the eggs, the process of extracting the eggs is basically the same.
It's exactly the same.
And so, Corinne, could you talk about some of the reasons why, as you go through this economic analysis that you've seen? Because I know people who have had the egg freezing, and a lot of them just were, they were ready to have children. They just didn't have a partner to have children with. So what are some of the reasons that women make this investment?
Yeah, so that's exactly right. There's a sociologist named Marcia Inhorn who wrote a book about this called Motherhood on Ice, and she did a ton of interviews with people who are freezing eggs, and she found that the reason that they were usually stating was a relationship reason. So very similar to me, where I said I'd gone through a divorce and, you know, then needed to consider that next step of being having another child, who I now have, by the way. I should also say that I have a one-year-old. The end of this journey is that I have a one-year-old.
So it works.
Yes. And I can share a little bit more about, you know, what that process was like. But they had broken up with a boyfriend, or they had decided they're in a long-term relationship, but they're not ready to have kids, or one of them is ready and one of them isn't ready. Or, you know, they had hoped something was going to work out with a relationship. It didn't work out. So they would very often state a reason that had to do with relationships, which is really interesting, because the stereotype up to that point had been that it had to do with careers, that this was the high-powered career woman who was saying, no, I'm going to make partner first, and then I'm going to have kids, so that's why I'm going to freeze my eggs. But when she was talking to women, it was more of the relationships that were at the forefront. Mm-hmm. But for me, in studying it and studying the patterns in when women have children and how access to assisted reproductive technology changes that, I think it's actually a combination of both.
Go ahead and finish your thought. I had a follow-up. Yeah.
That basically women are investing more in their careers, and they're pushing back the timeline for partnering and deciding and moving to that next step of having children. And so they are investing in their careers. They're going to school for longer. They are becoming doctors and lawyers and CEOs. And then they're searching for a partner and trying to finalize those relationships in their 30s rather than in their 20s. Mm. So then that means that if something doesn't work out, now they're facing that kind of reproductive deadline in a way that people weren't when we were for making some of these choices and decisions in their 20s. So I absolutely think careers have an influence as well.
And my follow-up to you, because we heard emotional insurance policy yes. from our very first caller. Yes. And then emotionally, what did that do for you personally? And what have you seen and read about for other women? Just knowing that, okay, my eggs are there. If I need them in the future, you know, when you're dating and trying to find that right partner.
Yes, absolutely. It gives you the chance to make the right decisions for you, because I think, you know, we're both old enough to remember probably talking to girlfriends 10, 15 years ago when this wasn't as much of an option, mm-hmm. who would literally say, well, I know that things aren't perfect, but I want to have a baby. And so we're going to need to make this work, right? And so people who would need to actually settle. And I have a study on this about IVF being made free in Israel. They were one of the first countries to fully fund IVF. And what you see is that women who are in relationships, engaged, ready to get married, call off those marriages. We see the age at marriage go up as soon as IVF is made free. It actually changed the formation of relationships because people were able to say, you know what? I'm going to take a beat and I'm going to see if this is right, because I now have that insurance policy of I know I'm going to have access to my reproductive capital a little bit later.
It sort of takes the pressure off. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We'd love to hear from you this hour. Our question is the following. How have you thought about fertility as you age and balance other life goals? Do you have a story about egg freezing, IVF, embryo freezing? 888-477-9499. Our email is studio2@whyy.org. I wanted to bring in another caller now. This is Peg from Princeton. Mm-hmm. Peg, you're on Studio 2. What's the story you'd like to share with us?
Hi there. The story I'd like to share is back in 1993, I got married to my husband, and we started trying to have a family, and we had difficulty conceiving. Mm. And so then we sought out fertility treatment, and it was the, you know, baseline fertility treatment of kind of being fertilized in the doctor's office. And then he died in 1994. Mm. And I took a year off. I'm sorry. There was one piece I forgot. We then froze we froze embryos.
Yeah.
And so I had 5 embryos. And after he died, I was feeling like, wow, who gets to do this? It was a big decision to move forward as a single mom, but, I waited a year and I decided to go ahead with pregnancy. Mm. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to get pregnant or carry the I did get pregnant, but carried the pregnancy to term.
Yeah.
But through all this, the only thing it did for me was give me the options, as you've been discussing, but also it made things easier for me. Mm-hmm. I still have those options.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the other comment I would make was from my experience, the fertility treatments weren't back in the 90s. It wasn't difficult. I was able to give myself the shots and do the routines, but it wasn't difficult for me. I find that it was pretty easy, actually. Yeah.
Thank you for sharing that story, Peg. That was really powerful.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I want to encourage other folks to call 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. Something that Corinne brought up earlier, Anne, is that this gives people the option to start a family later in life. I want to talk about the medical implications of that on the other side of this break. You're listening to Studio 2 on WHYY. Don't go anywhere. And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Before we get back into our conversation on how modern women are grappling with biological clocks, we've got to shout out our next Studio 2 on the Road event. Coming up, Tuesday, August 25th, live from noon to one, we'll be at America's First Official Hospital.
That's right, folks. We'll be at the newly opened Pennsylvania Hospital Museum to talk about 275 years of medical history and the groundbreaking idea advanced by Benjamin Franklin that healthcare should be for everyone, not just those who can afford it.
Yeah, and after our live broadcast, attendees will be able to tour the new museum and see the first medical library and the first surgical amphitheater. Again, it's Tuesday, August 25th from noon to 1. It's a free event, but you need to register at whyy.org/events, and I hope to see you there.
Now back to our conversation, fueled by those headlines over the weekend that 36-year-old Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has started the process of freezing her eggs.
Yeah, and with us in studio, we have Corinne Lowe, author of Having It All, What Data Tells Us About Women's Lives and Getting the Most Out of Yours. We also have reproductive endocrinologist Dr. Ann Hutchinson.
And we'd love to hear from all of you out there. How have you thought about fertility as you age and balance other life goals? Or maybe just more generally, tell us about how you decided when and if to have children. Our number is 888-477-9499. Our email is studio2@whyy.org. YouTube, Facebook, comment in the live chat. So I teed this up before the break, Dr. Hutchinson. But if you have now a reality where more people, and again, it's not a huge number of people, but more people can, you know, move back that clock of when they decide to start their family, which means you're going through pregnancy later, your early years as a parent are a little later in your life. Is there a big impact of that? I mean, what do you see as you watch people who are a little older now maybe start to go through this process?
Yeah, so I think that really what egg freezing, embryo freezing is going to allow us to do is to help improve the likelihood of getting pregnant as we are older, right?
Yeah.
So for folks who want to be able to build their families in their late 30s, early 40s, mid 40s, really keeping that door open in terms of ability to get pregnant by utilizing that egg quality potentially from an earlier age. In terms of actually carrying a pregnancy and being a parent, obviously, there are some things where risk will increase slightly as you get older. So for our folks who are pursuing pregnancy now in their mid-40s or even into their early 50s, we always have them talk with their OBGYN before moving towards pregnancy. For anybody that has any underlying medical conditions, we always have them have a clearance letter from their doctors just to have that discussion about what are the physiologic changes of pregnancy? How are they going to impact you, right?
Yeah.
Because more underlying medical conditions are going to accumulate if you're pursuing pregnancy at later ages. But most of these folks, as long as there are no underlying medical conditions, tend to do fantastically throughout the course of pregnancy. They're monitored by their OBGYNs, potentially followed a bit more closely by maternal fetal medicine doctors, just looking at kind of pregnancy progression, growth. But generally, we see wonderful outcomes once we're able to kind of correct for that kind of chromosomal content within the embryo, which is really what comes down to egg age and time at which you undergo the treatment.
Yeah, let's bring in another caller. We have Barbara calling from West Virginia with a question.
Okay.
Barbara, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
It's actually a question. I was wondering if you might address when women, especially younger women, are making the choice between saving eggs versus saving embryos, can you address the issue of disposition of eggs versus embryos? Because there's kind of a difference there.
Yeah. So when it's eggs, you're just dealing with your own rights. Mm-hmm. When you have an embryo, a lot of times, especially with a partner, you're involving the rights of the man mm-hmm. involved. So I don't know. I guess Dr. Ann.
Sure. I'm happy to speak about it a bit.
Could you talk about something? Because there's some legal issues that would likely come up here.
Yeah. So for all of our folks, whether they're undergoing egg freezing, whether they're undergoing embryo freezing, part of the consent process from the very beginning is talking about what disposition preferences would be. And those can be changed throughout the course of the time that they have those gametes or embryos in storage. But we always have something on paper from them at the time that they begin the process. So from an egg standpoint, you're absolutely right. That is going to be the individual who is undergoing the egg freezing process. They are going to have 100% control over what goes on with those eggs. And it will be the disposition will be their decision and their decision alone. Mm-hmm. For couples, if they're undergoing something like embryo freezing for fertility preservation or undergoing IVF and have additional embryos that are being frozen potentially for future use, that's something that we have them sign, decide on together and sign from the beginning. So if there is a situation that comes up in the future, if they decide to divorce or separate or part ways, or one of the partners passes away unexpectedly or whatever may happen, that we have at least a plan in place for those folks. And again, those plans can be changed as people have this ongoing discussion throughout the time that they have them frozen.
And I guess my question is sort of the biological limitations of this, because at the end of the day, like if you do egg freezing, you know, it doesn't always work. And so can you talk about that? I mean, Corinne, you raised your hand here because, you know, and I know people who've done, spent the money, went through the process, thought that they had this insurance policy, and then the insurance policy didn't pay out. So can you talk about that and the emotional attachment to having this you know, hopeful outcome that doesn't necessarily pan out?
Yeah, and I think that's why, you know, I mentioned those numbers of, you know, how many eggs you need to kind of give yourself a high chance, but a high chance is still, you know, a 90% chance. It's not 100%. And even if you had embryos, it's not 100%, but I'll just describe what my fertility doctor described as the embryo hunger games, okay? Each day there's fewer and fewer of the process that I went through. So my first cycle trying to freeze embryos, I harvested 23 eggs. And if I had just been freezing eggs, I might have just frozen those eggs and been like, I feel great about this. 23 eggs.
Yeah, that's a good number.
You know, harvested 23 eggs. I think only around 8 to 10 of them fertilized. Okay. Mm. The Hunger Games, there's fewer and fewer. And then only 4 of them turned into blastocysts, which is that they grow to a certain number of cells in a petri dish before they'll be frozen. And then I went through the genetic testing to verify that they were genetically viable, and none of those blastocysts were genetically viable. And believe me, I cried. Like, it just absolute devastation. Imagine. And even at that point in the process, you know, there was no even implantation, miscarriage, but just to have gone through that process and to find out, you know, that this did not work. And as I said, if I had frozen eggs, I would have said 23 eggs. I feel good about that. And
so if
I might
have stopped at step one
at eggs. Yeah. I might not have done a second cycle because I would have maybe thought that that felt like enough, but it wasn't right at my age. That wasn't enough. When I then went through my second cycle, I actually got fewer eggs. I got 17 eggs, but more of them fertilized. They made some changes to, they used a process called ICSI, which is they actually put each sperm into the egg individually. So more of them fertilized. And then, you know, I ended up with the same number of blastocysts and multiple ones that were genetically normal. So, you know, I had my daughter and then still had. But the funny thing about freezing embryos, and so why do people do eggs? Well, eggs gives you much more option value, right? Because you might not know if you want to do embryos, you have to know who you're having a child with or what kind of sperm donor you want to choose if it's on your own. And so for me, even though I was going to be in a same-sex relationship, I kind of had this consideration of potentially wanting the sperm donor to look like whoever I was going to end up in a relationship with. And so I had was very early in dating who's now my wife when I did that first cycle. And so there was kind of no consideration because I was already on the way. But when the first cycle failed and I was starting a second cycle, at this point now we've been dating for 4 months. We were getting a little bit more serious, but still not far enough along to like have a baby together now.
I want the sperm donor to look just like you.
Literally had to have that conversation 4 months in. Hey, if you think that you might want to do this with me one day, then maybe we should choose a donor who looks like you now, because that's going to give us that possibility. So had that awkward conversation 4 months in. And then the long story short is now we have a beautiful daughter who looks like both of us. And it gave us that time to continue developing our relationship and wait, you know, before we actually move forward with the process.
Yeah.
But that's why, you know, I have friends who the issue is they are in a long-term relationship and they're not 100% sure. And then some of them, friends who had that awkward conversation to say, I'm going to freeze some embryos and some eggs in case we end up going a different way. To have both paths available
to you. That's fascinating. By the way, you can give us a call if you have something to share on this topic, 888-477-9499. A commenter on YouTube says, my daughter's mom and I went through the IVF process, and Corinne's experience sounds similar to what we experienced. Thanks for that comment. Sarah says, I'm a woman in my 30s. I don't know if I want kids, but it's less about my career and more about my cohort. Most of my peers aren't having kids because it feels unviable to afford, and also feels like we're living through a uniquely unstable period. That's Sarah's comment. I wanted to return to something you were talking about earlier, Corinne, about sort of relationships often being the driving force behind these decisions. And we had a commenter earlier, Luann, who said like men need to do more, essentially. What is all this whole conversation do you think telling us about modern relationships, modern society? Like what do you think is like kind of the 30,000 foot view takeaway from this, you know, ostensibly medical conversation we're having.
Yeah, and the commenter said it really well, that there is just a lot of general ambivalence about parenthood right now, because it is difficult. That, you know, it is extremely time intensive. Parents today spend way more time with our kids than parents a generation ago. Working moms today spend more time with kids than stay-at-home moms in the 1970s.
Right.
Wow. So it's way more time intensive. It's way more expensive in terms of child care. We haven't kept up in terms of, you know, other countries. There's been additional subsidies, additional programs, additional ways to fill those gaps of summer breaks and after school care. And we haven't kept up policy-wise to support American parents in doing this. I just wrote an article about the fact that, you know, even when you look at something like the diarrhea lettuce outbreak, that's a burden we're putting on parents, because instead of monitoring food safety, now we're saying, okay, parents, now you can't eat the pre-bagged salad mix. Now you have to, you know, choose everything and wash everything yourself because the government's not keeping your food supply safe. So we are putting so much on parents. And modern relationships are also at this sort of awkward stage where one dynamic is that men have a longer window of fertility. So this delayed adulthood that's going on, men can kind of be in that for longer.
And delay it a little more.
Mm-hmm. And the entry-level job market is not great. And so some men are feeling like, well, I'm not where I want to be in my career. I'm not earning enough money. But they're able to put off their fertility. But for women, it's a little bit harder. And then there's also this mismatch between roles in relationships, where women are now often equals in terms of breadwinning as men, but men have not stepped up to do the same level of parenting or housework that women do. And so sometimes that's the issue in a relationship, where a woman says, well, wait a minute, am I going to be kind of wearing both of those hats? If I have a child, now I'm adding one more person to this household where I'm already doing so much. So I think there's a lot of forces creating a lot of this ambivalence.
And a lot of women don't want to be single moms by choice. That is another thing. I wanted to ask about accessibility a little bit, because a lot of the people who are able to get access to these choices, given the dynamics and the squishiness of relationship statuses, you tend to be more educated, more affluent. A lot of times it's not people of color who have access to this. Maybe they don't have jobs that provide them with this type of access. Can you talk about that a little bit? As far as like, if you see shifts happening to make egg freezing and just IVF generally, and some of these medical advances, more accessible to all different types of people at different income levels.
Yeah. So I think that as we continue to become more efficient with the process with which we are able to complete egg freezing from an embryology standpoint, it becomes less expensive over time as we become more efficient at it from a medical standpoint. I think that the medications that are required also are trending towards becoming less expensive over time to try to improve the accessibility of these things. Mm. There are wonderful grant programs that exist as well that can be available to different folks who are interested in pursuing it. But I agree with you. That is one of the biggest barriers that we see, that people will express interest in undergoing this process, but it may not be something that they can approach financially if they don't have help from their family, if they don't have the savings, and if they don't have coverage as part of their insurance.
Yeah.
A couple of sort of practical questions I wanted to squeeze in before we end the show. Says, I'm a woman in my early 30s considering freezing eggs, and I'm curious if I've been on birth control most of my adult life, so not ovulating, does this extend my fertility window when I'm ready to have children?
That's a question we hear all the time. And unfortunately, the answer is no. I wish that it was so simple. But the idea behind being on the birth control pill is that it stops the brain ovary communication. It kind of puts a little bit of a pause button on that. So while you still have that cohort that's rising into competition every month, your brain isn't selecting one out to grow and ovulate. So therefore, you aren't able to get pregnant on your own. But those eggs are still kind of, you know, petering out in the background at the same level. So the age of menopause isn't shifted after being on birth control for a long time.
Yeah. Real quick, JW asks, if you decide not to use the eggs, are you paying for the storage for life?
No. Well, you can decide that you want to discard those eggs at any point where you feel comfortable. So if you have reached a point where you have built your family and you feel confident that you're not going to use those eggs, completely and totally up to you what you want to do for those. If you want to thaw and discard those eggs, you can do that at any point.
Can you donate?
You can donate those eggs.
Yeah.
There are processes that are in place for that as well.
And what's the annual fee about for our storage?
A couple $100s a year. It's going to vary slightly depending on where you have them stored.
It can be $500 to $1,000. Mine is $800 a year. year. And I will just say that that's one reason I don't necessarily recommend people say, oh, I'm going to do this at 20, because, you know, you're going to be paying for storage each year. And you still
pay
have
for decades of storage.
And you still have very good egg quality in your early 30s. And so I usually recommend that people consider, you know, if you're getting towards 35 and you're not ready to start thinking about having a child right now, that's a good time to think about it, because you're going to have very good egg quality. And also, even at that age, if you have that, if you want multiple children, you might have the first child successfully.
It's always the last kid. It's always the last kid you want to have.
And we're going to squeeze one more question in. Wayne from South Jersey asks, is there any connection between breast cancer and IVF? And, you know, is this a myth? Is there any truth to this?
So we've looked at this very carefully, and there have been good studies that have looked at folks who have undergone up to 6 cycles of IVF, ovarian stimulation, and we haven't seen any increased risk of hormonally sensitive cancers. For women that are diagnosed with breast cancer, it's also something that often we will have a conversation with them about undergoing egg freezing before they go through chemotherapy, and that has been shown not to change their overall survival.
You did that in 30 seconds.
I thank everyone, by the way, our guests and our callers, for opening up this hour. Yes. This was a really fascinating conversation, and we hope it was a helpful one as well. Let me thank our guest, Corinne Lowe, Wharton Economics Professor, author of Having It All, What Data Tells Us About Women's Lives and Getting the Most Out of Yours. Corinne, thanks for being on Studio 2.
Thank you so much.
And Anne Hutchinson, reproductive endocrinologist at CCRM Fertility of Delaware and Philadelphia. It was a pleasure to have you.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Garten on Facebook says, if I were younger and not married, I would freeze my eggs. Motherhood can throw you through a loop. Thank you so much, Garten, for that comment. And of course, thank you so much to our producers, Debbie Builder, Hazel May Bryant, and Ben Abrams. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolf-Manarit. We'll talk to you tomorrow.